I own a small cabin on the edge of town that you can use just as long as you like, Mr. Washington. I think the story of Ma and Pa is one that should be told, honestly and truthfully.
I'll have to interview all of the children extensively, and that will take some time. And I'll have to have access to all of your parents' papers and notes.
You can talk to us all you want, but you'll have to have Pa's permission to read all the letters and diaries and such. And Ma kept a record of everything that went on from the time she first met Pa, back in Kentucky, I think it was.
Yeah, that was right after Pa and Hannah escaped from that Shawnee village where they'd been held prisoner.
Tell me what you know about that. I want to get everyone's perspective on everything.
Well, that's going to take some time. Especially when Jolene here starts running her mouth.
And I have a few things I can tell Mr. Washington about you too, brother.
Oh, hell.
Four days after the shootout, Jamie's saddled up, heading north for the Dakotas. Earlier, at a town with a telegraph, he had wired his detective agency, and they had responded the same day. There was a trading post of sorts on the Rapid River, just to the east of the Black Hills. Jamie had received word by wire that two or three of the men he sought were hanging around up there. Jamie forded the Niobrara and then crossed the White. The Cheyenne River was running low, and Jamie forded it easily, heading due north. Days later, he crossed the Battle in the spring. He saw many bands of Indians, but they left him alone. Jamie had heard that the Indians were on the prowl in this area due to a few white men coming in search for gold in the sacred Black Hills, but the word had been passed from tribe to tribe about Jamie. The bands of Indians only watched in silence as Jamie made his lonely way north. Inside the trading post, Lonnie Rayburn and Jed Hudson, the two thugs who had escaped the shootout in the trading post on Ham's Fork, had decided they weren't going to run any farther. Lonnie and Jed were just about at the end of their string. They were down to their last few dollars, and their nerves were ragged and raw from the nearly 2 years of relentless pursuit by Jamie Ian McAllister. Gary Crane, who had ridden in about a week back with hard news, was in just as bad a shape, but he too had decided he would run no more. The owner of the trading post, who had fought both Indians and outlaws during his long years on the frontier, and who knew all about Jamie McAllister, watched with amused eyes as the three men grew more and more jumpy. McAllister was coming, and the outlaws knew it.
I see we ambush him, or backshoot him.
The owner knew that these dregs of society would never ambush that wily old wolf McAllister, and odds were against them ever even getting into position to backshoot him. They made their brags that they would run no more, so that left them only one option, stand and fight. It was going to be right interesting when McAllister did ride up, for a few minutes at least. Then the owner looked up, and Jamie McAllister was standing in the doorway, looking like an avenging angel, holding the sawed-off greener in his hands. Lonnie Rayburn felt eyes on him and looked up, the color draining from his face.
Oh, my God.
Rayburn jumped to his feet, frantically clawing for his pistol. Jamie lifted the sawed off with one hand. Gary Crane managed to jerk out both pistols before the second blast caught him full force in the belly and knocked him to the floor.
I yield! Don't shoot, McAllister! I give it up!
You would complicate my life by turning yellow on me, boy.
I got witnesses. I ain't grabbing no iron. I'm surrendering. You wouldn't shoot no man with his hands in the air.
The trading post owner's head rose above the counter where he'd been hiding.
Oh, hell, shoot the son of a bitch, McAllister. The nearest army post is 100 miles to the northeast, man. It ain't even got a name yet. The 17th Infantry is there.
And shut your mouth, you old fool. I'm surrendering.
I'd take a bullet over hanging, boy. Think about it.
Get his guns and hold them till I get shackles from my saddlebags. I'll not shoot no man with his hands in the air.
Oh, shit. A lot of fuss and bother, you ask me.
Jamie got heavy handcuffs and ankle shackles from his supplies and chained Jed down tight.
I'll drag the bodies out. Where do you want to plant them?
Wherever you've a mind to. Now, I ain't digging no holes for the likes of them.
That ain't decent.
You're a fine one to talk about decent. You'll dig the holes. Move.
I'll wet my britches.
You'll do more than that when they hang you. I hear tell you dump a full load when the rope tightens.
God damn you!
Jamie found a shovel and tossed it to the outlaw, who awkwardly caught it with his shackled hands.
Out back. I'll resupply while you dig, and then we're gone.
Foolishness, if you ask me. I just shoot him and be done with it.
Jamie pulled out at dawn with the shackled Jed Hudson in tow. Now that the certainty of what faced him had sunk home, Jed was at first angry and then fell into a sullen mood, which suited Jamie just fine. He didn't have time for a lot of chit-chat, for he was traveling at a steady pace, putting a lot of miles behind him. It was late afternoon when Jamie called a halt and rubbed down the horses and picketed them on good graze close to water. Just before dark, he moved them close to the camp. The Indians wouldn't harm man who is not afraid, but it would be a good joke on him to steal his horses.
There's Injuns out there.
They won't bother me. They might take your hair, but they won't bother me.
I guess you think that's funny.
Nope, just stating a fact.
That old man back yonder at the trading post, he'd have shot me outright, wouldn't he?
Without giving it a second thought.
I didn't have no choice, really. I had to become an outlaw.
Well, is that right?
Yeah. You see, my daddy whipped me a lot.
Obviously, he didn't whip you enough.
And I always wanted me a paint pony like the boy down the road had. But Pa, he said we didn't have the money for one.
So you stole one.
Huh? How'd you know that?
Call it a lucky guess.
Well, it ain't right for some to have more than others.
Someday, someone may come up with a word to cover that kind of thinking.
Are you going to make me sleep with these shackles on my ankles and wrists?
All night long.
That ain't right neither. Suppose I give you my word I won't try to run away.
You've got to be joking.
It was worth a try, weren't it? Hey, it don't bother you a bit that I'm going to hang, do it?
Not a bit.
Why? You don't know me. I can tell you for a fact it wasn't me who shot your wife.
I suppose now you're going to tell me you didn't shoot anybody that day in Valley. Or in any other 50 or so towns the Nelson gang has raided. Or you never harmed a soul on a stage or a train. Or you never took part in any of the foul deeds done to women and young girls at lonely farm and ranch houses.
Suppose I say I'm sorry about them things.
Tell it to a judge and jury.
I will. And they'll believe me, too.
Jamie smiled and took a dodger out of his jacket pocket.
Now, let's see here. Thomas Jed Hudson. Wanted for murder and rape and robbery in Missouri, Kansas, and Colorado. Wanted for cattle rustling and murder in Texas and Arizona. Wanted for rape in Arkansas. You helped torture a woman to death in Louisiana. You want me to go on?
I reckon not.
Then eat your supper and shut up.
Federal Marshal Pat Riordan had stopped at the Army installation for food and rest. He was just about ready to leave when scouts reported back to the commanding officer that Jamie McAllister was on his way in with a man who was shackled in the saddle. Marshall smiled and decided to delay his departure. Inside the post compound, Jamie jerked Jed out of the saddle and asked for the commanding officer.
No need for that. Pat Riordan, United States Deputy Federal Marshal.
You want this yahoo?
Oh yeah, I sure do. Let's stick him in the stockade and go get something to eat and drink. Then you can bring me up to date on members of the Nelson gang you found, so I can scratch them off my list.
McAllister ain't no law dog. He didn't have no authority to arrest me and shackle me like a wild animal and haul me all over the country. I got rights, you know.
Shut up, Hudson. I just got me a notion, Mac, that 100 years from now, enforcing the law is going to be a real problem.
100 years from now, Pat, what the hell difference will it make to you and me?
Pat took Jamie's arm, and together they walked off to get something to eat. It was midsummer and hot as Jamie rode into Abilene, Kansas. After stabling his horses, Jamie checked into the drover's cottage. He was unaware that the town marshal, James Butler Hickok, better known as Wild Bill, was also staying at the drover's cottage. Wild Bill had taken over as city marshal in April of 71, shortly after the death of Thomas Smith, also known as Bear River Smith. After checking in, a long hot bath, a haircut and a shave, his boots blacked, a white shirt laundered and pressed, and a suit aired and ironed, Jamie stuck 144 behind his sash and took a stroll around the town. He hadn't gone a block before Wild Bill stepped out of a store, and the two men came face to face on the boardwalk. Hickok was tall, but not as tall as Jamie, more as heavy.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Elstone and Rod Totten usually hit the Alamo Saloon about dark.
Jamie nodded his head. Hickok walked on, and so did Jamie. Jamie ate an early supper and wandered over to the Alamo Saloon just before dusk. John Wesley Harden, the volatile and totally unpredictable gunfighter, was sitting at a table near the back, drinking whiskey and playing solitaire. Harden, a native of Texas, born in Bonham of God-fearing and hard-working parents, his father was a Methodist circuit preacher, held in high esteem the men who fought and died at the Alamo, and held in particular high esteem the legendary Jamie Ian McAllister.
Hey, McAllister. The ones you waiting on? They'll be along shortly. They've been running their mouths about killing you. Don't worry about your back. I'll watch it for you.
Jamie turned and nodded his head in thanks. Harden resumed his card playing, and Jamie nursed his whiskey. Hickok had saddled up and rode out of town to visit a lady friend who lived a few miles outside of Abilene. Wild Bill was totally sympathetic with Jamie's manhunt and wanted to give him all the free rein possible in dealing with Stone and Totten. Word had gotten to Stone and Totten that Jamie was in town. The two outlaws had no choice in the matter. They had boasted all around town about what they would do if McAllister ever showed up in Abilene. Now they had to back up their words or be branded cowards and leave town. The outlaws propped up their courage with whiskey in Ben Thompson's Bull's Head Tavern, and just at dark, headed for the Alamo Saloon. They walked into the saloon with guns drawn. Jamie was already moving. He snaked his .44 out of his sash and drilled Al Stone through the heart. Stone fell against Totten and took the bullet meant for Jamie. Jamie stood and took aim. His bullet struck Totten in the chest and knocked the man back against the wall. Totten lifted his second .45 and Jamie fired again, the .44 round striking the outlaw on the belly. Totten slid down the wall, coming to rest on his butt on the floor. His gun slipped from numbed fingers.
Damn your eyes, McAllister. You don't never give a man breathing room. You just kept on coming. Judy will kill you for your...
Totten died with his eyes wide open, staring death in the face. Jamie carefully reloaded.
Will Judy. He's a bad one, Mac. Don't sell him short.
This Will Judy, you know where he is?
That I don't know, Mac. But he likes the high country and rides with a no-good name of Tom Brewer. And Brewer ain't no man to take lightly.
Nice meeting you, John Wesley.
I assure you that pleasure was all mine, Jamie Ian McAllister.
Toast! Long live the memory of the Alamo and the men who fought and died there.
I'll drink to that.
Fall was blowing cold when Jamie rode into the little two-by-twice town on the Colorado-New Mexico border. He'd picked up the trail of the three men nearly 6 weeks back and had dogged them all the way. They had tried every trick they knew to shake Jamie off their trail, but nothing had worked. Sam Woodson, Art Adams, and Ramsey Wicks were at the end of their string and all played out when they hit what was left of the tiny town. The blacksmith looked at Jamie in the fading light and shook his head.
If you be Jamie McAllister, and I think you are, them hombres you've been dogging is in the saloon. They said for me to tell you they ain't running no more.
You build caskets?
Yeah.
Build three.
Every time I pick up a newspaper, there's something about you in it. 6 months old, a year old, 2 weeks old, it don't make no difference. You and your damn manhunt is in all of them. Do you even know how many men you killed, McAllister?
You mean in the Nelson gang?
Yes.
39 to date, I think. Soon it'll be 42.
39 souls you sent winging.
Sent winging straight to hell.
Jamie wiped off his Colts, working the action, then checked the loads, filling up the sixth chamber on each Colt. Finally snapped closed the cylinders and slipped the pistols back into leather.
How old are you, Jamie McAllister?
61, I believe. I've never been real sure about that.
You don't look it. Except maybe the eyes. What do you want done with your horses and gear if you don't come back for them?
Instructions are in my saddlebags.
I'd wish you luck, except I don't believe in what you're doing.
It's all right. I don't believe in luck.
Jamie walked across the street and pushed open the back window, stepping into the saloon. The bartender slid a bottle and a glass down to Jamie and hit the air, bolting to the storage room. The half-dozen other patrons and one henna-haired, worn-out, and used-up-looking soiled dove took tables close to the wall. Sam Woodson, Art Adams, and Ramsey Wicks were standing up at the far end of the saloon, hand over the butts of their guns.
Now you hear me good, McAllister. I'm tired of you dogging my back trail. Well, this here's gonna end tonight, you got me?
Jamie, using his left hand, poured a drink and sipped it. He held the greener in his big right hand. He said nothing, only smiled.
It ain't right what you been doing. We's human beings. What's done is done. And you ain't gonna change it.
Yeah, well, you can go fuck yourselves.
Ramsey reached for his guns. Ramsey slammed against the wall and slid down. Sam Woodson grabbed iron and cleared leather, tossing a wild shot in Jamie's direction. Jamie was no longer there. After firing the first barrel, he had set his drink down, dropped into a crouch, and duck walked behind the bar, reloading the sawed off as he went.
Where the hell did it go?
Jamie stood up behind the bar.
Right here.
Jamie dropped the greener and hauled iron just as Sam Woodson shifted his weight and brought up his guns. Falling backward, Sam pulled the triggers and blew two holes in the ceiling of the saloon. Jamie returned to the end of the bar and his drink, reloading the sawed-off on the way. He took a sip of the whiskey and peered through the acrid screen of gun smoke that hung thick in the saloon. Satisfied that no more lead was going to come in his direction, Jamie took out a creased sheet of paper and a stub of pencil and drew a line through three more names on the list. The bartender opened the door to the storage room and peeked out.
Is it over?
You offer food here?
Sorta. Stew and bread is all we got.
Then I'll be back in an hour. Have some hot for me.
Jamie finished his drink and walked out into the gathering night. He stood for a moment, breathing deeply of the cold air, then stepped off the boards and returned to the livery. The smithy stood just outside the open double doors of the stable, a hammer and saw in his hands, a carpenter's apron tied around his waist.
How many coffins did you say?
Three, just like I told you.
They got any money on them?
I have no idea.
Well, I guess their guns will be worth something.
And their horses.
True. You gonna pray now and ask the Lord for forgiveness?
No.
You ought to. Terrible thing taking a man's life. What are you gonna do?
Wash my hands and face and have supper. I'm hungry.
Ben F. Washington sat on the front porch of the small house and watched the sun sink over the mountains. He was at peace with himself and the world. He had never known such inner peace. Ben stuffed his pipe with tobacco and fired it up, filling the air with the fragrant scent. With a sigh and a contented smile, Ben right then and there made up his mind as to his future. He had made a tentative offer to the agent, editor, and owner of the local newspaper, and the man had accepted. Ben would see him tomorrow and firm up the deal.
Yes, I am home.
Jamie dropped out of sight for almost 6 weeks after the shootout in the dying little no-name town. No one saw him except Indians. They were not exactly on speaking terms with most whites. When he again surfaced, it was in eastern Nevada, in a wild and woolly town called Pioche. It was an isolated place, closest town of any size being Hamilton, almost 100 miles away to the north. One rumor had it that of the first 100 people to be buried in the local cemetery, none died of natural causes. After a well-needed bath and shave and haircut, Jamie dressed in his best suit and had the first meal in many weeks that he hadn't had to cook himself over an open fire. By now, thanks to a gabby and very excited desk clerk, every man, woman, and child within the city limits, if indeed there were any known city limits, knew that Jamie was in town and on the prod. And so did Barry Herman and Skip Beach, the two members of the Miles Nelson gang that Jamie had tracked to the town. Herman and Beach were exhausted and very nearly at wits' end. They'd been on a hard run for more than 2 years, not daring to stay in one place for any length of time, for Jamie Ian McAllister was always just a step or two behind them. Herman drank too much Who Hit John in an attempt to screw his courage to the sticking place and call Jamie out. Jamie obliged him.
You son of a bitch! I'm gonna end this right here, right now, this minute!
Then make your play, Tin Horn!
You think I'm afraid of you, McAllister? You damn old buzzard!
I think you're a two-bit back-shooting, woman-killing punk!
Barry Herman jerked iron. Stepping into the center of the street, he began wildly firing. Jamie calmly drew his gun, took deliberate aim in the murky light of dusk, and shot Barry Herman right between the eyes.
Now, face me.
From the darkness of an alley, Skip Beach lifted his pistol and pulled the trigger. The cartridge misfired, the action jammed, and that was all the time Jamie needed. He lifted his .44 and drilled Skip in the belly.
You son of a bitch!
Skip dropped the useless pistol and hauled another gun out of his waistband. Jamie fired again. The bullet striking Skip in the hip and spinning him around. Still game and still on his boots, the outlaw lifted his pistol. Jamie plugged him with a well-placed shot to the heart. Jamie holstered his pistol and walked back to his room. Come the morning, Pioche, Nevada would see the last of him.
I hear tell McAllister killed two more men down in Nevada about 2 months ago.
More of the Nelson gang?
Yep. Some gun slicks named Herman and Beach. Old Mike never flinched. Just stood out tall and tough and plain in the street and gunned them down like dirty bastards they is. Or was, I should say.
Two unshaven and roughly dressed men seated at a corner table of the saloon looked up at the words spoken by the trapper to the barkeep and exchanged glances. All heads turned to stare at the door. The tall, erect, and powerfully built man with the gray hair and mustache, deeply tanned face, and cold, piercing eyes, removed his heavy winter coat and hung it on a peg, brushed back his hip-length coat, exposing twin Colts, and walked to the bar.
Whiskey.
The trapper took his drink and moved away from the bar, as did the cowboy at the far end of the bar. They both knew who the tall stranger was, and they had absolutely no desire to get caught by a stray bullet. Jamie took a sip of his whiskey and carefully placed the glass on the scarred bar.
Good whiskey. Hits the spot. But it stinks in here. Smells like outlaw scum to me.
Tom Brewer stood up from the table.
Oh, man. You've been dogging my back trail for more than 2 years now, and I'm tired of it. You've killed my friends and even some of my kin. Your killing stops right here.
Jamie turned to face him. It was then that Brewer noticed the short-barreled 12-gauge shotgun that Jamie had been holding in his left hand, pressed tight against his leg. Will Judy slipped away from the table and edged along the wall until coming to the back door. He opened the door and stepped out, headed for the livery across the street. If Tom had used his head, they could have double-teamed McAllister and taken him out. But Tom had allowed his hate to overcome logic. And Will hated a fool. Jamie let Will Judy leave. There was always another day.
My killing stops here? Is that a fact?
That's a fact, McAllister.
I don't think so, Brewer. I still got a goodly number of you trash to deal with.
Why, you beat up buzzard. You ain't half the man you used to be. You just think you are, you gray-headed old son of a bitch.
Make your peace with whatever God will claim you, Brewer. Then hook and draw.
You aging sack of shit.
Brewer grabbed iron. Jamie lifted the sod off and blew the killer all over the back end of the saloon. Jamie broke open the greener and pulled out the empties, loading it up fresh. Then he drained his glass of whiskey, retrieved his coat from the hook, and walked out of the saloon.
Son of a bitch. You reckon he'll get them all?
Bet on it.
Winter still locked the high country in a blanket of cold white when Jamie pushed open the door of the trading post located just outside of what was left of Fort Phil Kearney on the east side of the Bighorn Mountains. The fort had been abandoned by the army in 1868. Jamie was as rough-looking as his horses. Will Judy threw his cards on the table, pushed back his chair, and stood up as the handful of others in the room scattered for cover.
Son of a bitch! God damn you, man! Why don't you give this up and let people alone?
Because I made a promise standing over the grave of my wife, and I always keep my promises.
You can't beat me, McAllister! I'm younger and faster than you!
We'll see.
As soon as Will's eyes narrowed, Jamie drew, stepping to one side as he did, preparing to fire across his chest. Will was indeed fast with a gun, but Jamie's sudden move threw the outlaw's aim off just enough. Instead of the bullet striking Jamie in the center of the chest, it hit him in the left arm and immediately numbed the arm all the way to his hand. But Jamie's shot was true, the bullet striking the gunfighter outlaw in the chest and knocking him backward, but not down. Jamie fired again. With blood dripping from his wound, Jamie walked over to the dying man and kicked his pistol away.
I never thought it would be this way.
Nobody ever does. Miles Nelson, is he still up in Canada?
No. I won't die with a lie on my lips. I'm gonna have a hard enough time convincing St. Pete to let me in, as it is. You reckon I got a chance of doing that, McAllister?
Jamie started to reply and then closed his mouth. Will Judy was dead at his feet.
Mister, I know something about doctoring. Come over to the light and let me take a look at that arm.
Jamie took off his jacket and shirt and peeled his underwear shirt down to his waist. The men in the bar all sat in silence and stared at Jamie's heavy musculature. It was a build of a man 20 years younger. The bullet had passed through Jamie's arm, tearing a hole as it exited out the back just above the armpit. The man cleaned out the wound, poured whiskey front and back, and then bandaged the arm and shoulder.
You're lucky. If it had hit that big bone, it might have broken your shoulder or deflected off and wandered around in your chest. But you'll live. You're in marvelous shape for a man in his late 40s.
I'm 61 years old, mister.
Jesus Christ. I hope I'm so lucky.
Jamie lounged around the trading post for a week, allowing his wound to start its healing and to rest his horses. While he waited, he went through Will Judy's personal papers and found an envelope. There was no letter inside, but the envelope had been posted from Kansas City, Missouri. On the back of the envelope, the initials Reverend M.N., Church of the Enlightenment. Jamie knew that Miles Nelson was the son of a Methodist minister and a highly educated man, having taught school before turning to a life of depravity.
Yeah, you could probably get away with that. I'll just save you for last, Nelson. I might just shoot you down in front of your congregation after I expose you for what you are.
Jamie headed south until he hit the railroad, then followed the tracks east until coming to a town. There, he sent a telegraph to his sons and daughters in Valley. Start building me a cabin on the ridge overlooking your ma's grave. Stop. Bedroom, living room, kitchen, and a porch in the front, so I can sit in the evening and look down and see your ma's grave. Stop. I'll be home before the next snow flies. He sent another telegram to his detective agency and waited for a reply. When it came, only a few hours later, he went for supplies. He had a hard ride ahead of him. Weeks later, Jamie swung down from the saddle and led his weary horses to a livery in Bismarck, in the northern part of the Dakota Territory. It was not an outlaw haven. These people settling there were solid family folks, farmers for the most part. Camp Hancock was also under construction when Jamie arrived. The military garrison was there to protect workers on the Northern Pacific Railroad. Jamie had solid information that there were three outlaws who lived in the country a few miles from the town. If Jamie had his way, they wouldn't be living for long. He was certain he was not that well known in this part of the country. His name was, but not his face. He made arrangements to sleep in the loft of the livery. After a bath, Jamie was standing outside talking to the smithy when a wagon rolled by, two caskets in the bed.
Three hoodlums tried to rob Olenmeyer, but Olenmeyer has four big strapping sons, and they can shoot too, by golly. Kill those two hoodlums at the farm, and third lies dying over yonder in that building. Come to find out, they was all part of that terrible Miles Nielsen gang. The ones that gunfighter McAllister's hunting.
Do you know their names?
Yep. Judd, Moore, and Gentry.
Well, how about that?
Well, I do believe I'll just take me a nap.
Jamie rested himself and his horses for several days and then pulled out, heading south. At a trading post at the confluence of the Bad River and the Missouri, Jamie overheard some movers talking about the last of the Miles Nielsen gang. He listened without joining in the conversation.
Vic Tyler and Jordan Keller tried to hold up a bank down in Texas. They got shot up pretty bad, I hear tell, but they'll live to stand trial and hang.
Yep. 13 steps and the hangman is going to cheat Jamie McAllister out of finally getting them all. Now, I hear tell that they ain't but two of the gang left. Miles Nielsen himself and some young punk named Lloyd Jones. Now, Miles Nielsen has probably buried himself so deep nobody will ever find him. He's a rich man, I heard. And that Jones boy will try to pull something and get himself killed, I bet you.
Yep, you be right, I reckon.
Jamie bought his supplies and headed out. Several weeks later, at a crossroads post, Jamie learned that Miles Nielsen, going under the name of Matthew Nallen and posing as a preacher, had been discovered by federal marshals, and there had been a wild shootout inside the Church of the Enlightenment in Kansas City. Miles Nielsen had escaped.
You'll show up someday, and I'll be there waiting.
You say something, mister?
Just talking to myself, barkeep.
Oh, I do it, too. Gets lonesome at times. But lately there's people heading west by the droves. I sometimes see four or five new faces a day. It's about got me wore plumb down to a frazzle. Never seen nothing like it. You want some more coffee?
Well, thank you. Tastes good.
You look like you've been on the trail for quite a spell.
I have, for a fact. But now I'm going home.
Home, huh? That sounds good.
It sure does.
Jamie packed his supplies and headed out for Colorado. It was over. In mid-July of 1872, the longest and bloodiest manhunt in the history of the West came to a close. Jamie Ian McAllister had tracked down and killed some 44 men of the Miles Nielsen gang. In September, Jamie turned Buck's head and looked down the long main street of Valley. 2 minutes later, the whole town had turned out. Yeah! Little Ben Pardee played his harmonica, much to the amusement of the new owner of the newspaper, Ben F. Washington. Jamie's daughters, granddaughters, and great-granddaughters wept at the sight. The son swallowed back sudden lumps in their throats. Jamie Ian McAllister, man who is not afraid, bear killer, man who plays with wolves, known now by the Indians as the Silver Wolf, had come home. Before he left the saddle to stand amid the throngs of people, Jamie looked up to the ridge overlooking the miles-long valley, to the flower-covered mound that was Kate's grave.
Howdy, old woman. My God, I miss you.
The whole town had pitched in. Jamie's cabin on a ridge overlooking Kate's grave and the grave of Jamie's grandfather was up in no time and waiting for Jamie's return. The cabin was a snug one, with large rooms and oversized doors so Jamie would not bump his head entering or leaving. And the cabin had been completely furnished and stocked with food for him. For the first afternoon and night back, Jamie's kith and kin left him alone to relax and to visit Kate's grave. Before visiting the gravesite, Jamie bathed and shaved and dressed in clean clothing. Then he went down to sit by Kate's grave and talk to her. He talked for more than an hour, telling her all the places he'd been since her death. When he was done talking, Jamie went to his cabin and fixed his supper, then sat in a rocking chair on the front porch and drank coffee and smoked his pipe. As the shadows lengthened, Jamie rocked and thought things over.
Well, I'll stick around here for a time, maybe a few weeks, just to get reacquainted with my grandkids and great-grandkids. But damned if I'm going to while away my years sitting here and rocking and just let the world go by. Nope, I'm still too young for anything like that. I got some good years left in me, and by damn, I'm not gonna waste them.
His mind made up, Jamie knocked out his pipe and went into the cabin. He turned up the twin lamps by his chair, found his reading glasses, and read the last 10 weeks of the Valley newspaper. Somebody had left him by the chair. Then his eyelids started getting heavy. He blew out the lamps and went to bed. He didn't bother locking the doors. Nobody in Valley locked doors. Jamie slept long and well, and he lingered under the comforter for a time. But before dawn, he was up and had breakfast. His belly full, Jamie took his cup of coffee and sat for a time in the coolness of the early morning, watching the town below wake up. When it was full light, Jamie stuck a .44 behind his belt and walked down to the town. Jamie marveled at how the town had grown as he stepped onto the main street and looked up and down. Then briefly, waves of sadness washed over him as he thought back to how it had been when those first few wagons had rolled onto the valley floor. Sweet and Hannah, Moses and Liza, Sam and Sarah, Juan and Maria and all the children. Now all the adults who had come west with him were dead. Jamie was the last one. Jamie smelled fresh coffee and looked around him. Damn if there wasn't a new cafe in town. He followed the smell of coffee brewing and biscuits cooking. Jamie bought a mug of coffee and sat on a bench outside, watching the town come alive for another day. Jamie's oldest, Jamie Ian Jr., walked up and sat down beside his father. He studied his pa's face for a moment.
You're not going to stay for long, are you, Pa?
I'll stick around for a few weeks, and I think I'll ramble.
Girls will be disappointed.
They'll get over it. There's nothing here for me, boy.
Your family's here, Pa. I guess I might as well be the one to tell you the news, Pa. Ben F. Washington bought the Valley Dispatch. Do you know who he is?
I know all about him, son. How's he doing?
Just fine. He's a likable fellow and a damn good writer. He wants to do a book about you and Ma.
It'd be real nice if some writer could get the facts straight, for a change.
Well, he wants permission to look over Ma's notes and letters and diary and such.
Let him look at them. It's all right with me. But I don't want the book published until after my death. I want that understood up front.
Ben said you'd probably say that. He's agreeable to it.
Then tell him if he wants to talk to me, he'd better get cracking. I aim to pull out before the snow flies.
Falcon's got a surprise for you, Pa.
Is Marie pregnant again?
No. That'll probably happen next year. She says she wants 10 children.
Good God.
And so does Mary Marie O'Donnell McAllister.
That's a mouthful, boy. I bet you can't say that 10 times fast. What's Falcon's surprise?
He found a horse for you. Name of Sundown. Said he knew it was for you the minute he saw it. Damn thing was so mean its owner was going to kill it till Falcon offered to take it off his hands. Come on, let's hitch up the buggy and take a ride out to Falcon's ranch.
Buggy? You going soft on me, boy.
It's easier on the butt, Pa.
You are getting kind of ample back there, boy. Easy living, I reckon.
Jamie went into town every day for coffee and conversation. The rest of the time, he worked with Sundown. Within a week, the monster horse was following him around like a puppy, nuzzling him and begging him for a slice of apple or a bit of sugar. Jamie put Buck out to stud. The horse had earned a long rest in the pasture, pleasuring the mares at Falcon's horse ranch. Jamie got reacquainted with all his kin, and very quietly met with attorneys and went over land deeds and other certificates of holding, making certain every I was dotted and every T was crossed. The young men who had been sent west to buy property and check out other investments had visited Valley. The trio were quickly wising up to the ways of the West, and it didn't take them long to realize that anybody who tried any shady deals in and around Valley would not last long and would probably end up shot or hanged or both. They told their fathers to forget that area of Colorado unless they had a death wish. The reporters from back east who had been sent out into the Wild West to cover Jamie's life and times had long since returned home. Trying to catch up with Jamie Ian McAllister was like attempting to get a firm grip on smoke. Jamie talked with Ben F. Washington every day at length, with Ben taking careful notes. And after going through Kate's diaries and journals, he had given the young man most of them. A few were just too personal, and those he had placed in a lockbox. Ben worked on his manuscript for at least an hour every day. There was no rush, for he had given his word that the book would not be published until after Jamie's death. Jamie said his goodbyes and pulled out in the fall of 72, heading east. He wanted to see the Big Thicket country one more time and to visit the grave of baby Karen, who was killed at 5 months of age in 29 during an outlaw raid. Jamie rode Sundown, and he had to admit that out of all the horses he'd ever had, the dark sand-colored animal was the finest horse he had ever ridden, standing several hands taller than any other horse Jamie had ever seen. A year passed, and Jamie knew he was piddling, just wasting time, but he was without direction, drifting. He didn't know what to do with the rest of his life. For almost 45 years, the center of his existence had been Kate. Now there was a great empty void in his being. In Austin, Jamie stabled his horses and checked into a hotel. Austin was a state capital, but it still had its wild and woolly places, and was also the home of the gunfighter Ben Thompson. Ben hadn't been out of the state pen long, having served his time for shooting his brother-in-law after the man had beat up Thompson's wife and threatening to kill a local justice of the peace. Jamie wanted no trouble, and he breathed a little easier when he learned from local gossip that Ben was raising hell up in Kansas. Jamie rested his horses, then provisioned up and put Austin behind him as he continued on west. At Fredericksburg, town settled by Germans in 1846 when it was right on the edge of the western frontier, Jamie was warned that the Comanches in Kiowa were on the warpath. But there were wagons filled with supplies gearing up to head west for El Paso in a couple of days. It would be a prudent move on Jamie's part to join them. The wagons would be accompanied by a detachment of cavalry heading for Fort Bliss. Jamie hunted up the wagon master. After the man had recovered from his shock at meeting one of the West's most famous men, he quickly agreed to Jamie coming along. It would be an honor, he said. The young cavalry officer in charge of the detachment of soldiers, as yet mostly untrained and untested in battle, was clearly in awe of Jamie and for 2 days followed him around like a lost puppy. The lieutenant, a recent graduate of West Point, and who until his trip to the Point and this grand adventure out west had never been more than 10 miles from his home in New Hampshire, amused Jamie, and he decided to take the young officer under his wing, so to speak, and to try to teach him enough about the frontier to keep him alive.
I'm to be posted here for 3 years, sir. Then I'm going to request duty somewhere in Montana or Wyoming.
Is that right?
Yes, sir. I'm told the Cheyenne are the most magnificent Indians to be found.
One of my sons married a Cheyenne princess.
My, I didn't realize that. And you're friends with the Indians?
I've been friends with him and fought him on occasion.
It would be a great honor to have you ride along with my detachment, sir. I mean, beside me, sir, not back with the... You know what I mean.
Relax, Cal. You're gonna do just fine out of here.
I'm looking forward to an encounter with the hostiles.
Not after the first one you won't be. If you live through it, that is.
But the Indians obviously thought the wagon train, some 25 wagons long, with both civilian guards and soldiers, too strong for him. Much to the disappointment of Lieutenant Sanders and the great relief of all the others, the trip to El Paso was uneventful. Scouting around, Jamie picked up a lot of Indian sign, but he saw no Indian, although he was sure they had seen him. Jamie did his best to pass along to the young lieutenant at least some of his knowledge about the frontier. By the time the wagons reached El Paso in the dead of late winter 1873, Lieutenant Sanders knew a little something about survival on the frontier. Jamie lounged around El Paso for a few days, trying to make up his mind where he wanted to go next. He didn't want to strike out alone across New Mexico and Arizona, for the Apache Nation was at war with the whites. On a cold morning in February, Jamie and 5 other men, all of them well-seasoned, which meant in the vernacular of the West, they were all graybeards, rode out of El Paso, heading west into New Mexico territory. In Las Cruces, 2 of the men decided to drop out of the group. That left Jamie, Red Green, an old mountain man who was called Logan, and a retired Army sergeant named Canby. Jamie's eyes were amused as he looked at his new friends, who now sat around a table in a Las Cruces saloon.
Boys, I reckon between the 4 of us, we've got about 200 years of Indian fighting. I aim to see me some new country before I cash in. I have ample money and I can get more. What say you we provision up and head into a country few white men have seen?
Why the hell not? We damn sure ain't getting no younger.
Suits me. Why not? Let's just make damn sure we got enough ammunition to ward off some engine attacks. Cause sure as God made little green apples, we're gonna have to fit some fights.
I like you boys' company, for a fact. I generally shy away from folks, but you boys is different. We get along. And you boys is trail-wise and don't jibber-jabber nonsense all the damn time. But you best understand something. Odds are that some of us, maybe all of us, won't be riding back. Apaches is about the most notional of all Injuns. I've lost good friends to the Apaches. And on the other hand, I've made friends with some Apaches. A few. This ain't gonna be no Sunday school picnic.
You all done preaching?
Sure.
Then let's ride.
Four men, average age 62, rode out and headed north, each trailing a pack horse. Most of the townspeople thought they were crazy, but they kept that opinion to themselves. They were heading into the Caballo Mountains and a trading post located on the Hot Springs about 60 miles north of Las Cruces. Each of the men wore two pistols belted around them and two pistols on holsters located on each side of the saddle horn. They all carried lever-action rifles and long-bladed bowie knives. Whether the four men had angels riding with them or if the Apaches were just looking the other way when they rode by was not known. But whatever the reason, Jamie and his compadres rode from Las Cruces to the Springs without incident. The owner of the Hot Springs trading post shook his head in wonder.
Well, it happens. Apaches is like rattlesnakes. I walked a foot from a damn rattler who didn't even raise his head to look at me. Other times, they start rattling and striking if you get within 50 feet of them. Apaches is the same way, I reckon. But if you see one, don't hesitate. Just blow the damn dirty heathen right off his horse. I hate every damn one of them.
Caused you some grief, have they?
Grief? I should say so. I tried to make friends with them when I first come out here. I'm still carrying the arrowhead in my side for that trouble. And I tried again. That time they burned down my cabin, killed my wife, and stole my horses. Shot me in the process. For the last 10 years, I've been shooting every goddamn one of them I could. We're gonna have to wipe them all out one of these days. We might as well get on with it, I say. You fellers is all past your prime, I'd say. Excepting you, maybe. I can't figure you. You boys just wandering?
Seeing the country.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is good luck. You're sure gonna need it.
Days later, four men found themselves pinned down on the east bank of a tiny creek. They were in good position in the rocky terrain, with the horses safe to their rear under the bluff.
You reckon them's Apaches?
They ain't your grandmother's tea party.
They made a mistake attacking us here. I think they'll soon realize it.
Yeah, you'll be right, I'm thinking. We got cover and water and a good field of fire in front of us. But we best watch careful to our flanks come the night.
I thought Apaches never attacked at night.
See, some do, some don't. Depends on whether their medicine's strong enough.
One small brown object had appeared in Jamie's line of view. He lifted his rifle and took careful aim. A bullet shattered an Apache kneecap. The Apaches came in a rush then, darting from rock to rock, bush to bush, until they were right on the edge of the clearing. Then they seemed to vanish into the earth.
Excellent. They've learned very well the warrior's way.
They didn't have to learn it so damn good.
Logan tensed for a few seconds, jerked up his rifle and fired. A young Apache, looking to be in his late teens, stood, his chest bloody, and then fell face forward on the rocks. He didn't move.
Well, that one didn't learn it so good.
Logan thumbed another round into his rifle. The fight continued all that afternoon, without either side inflicting any more damage on the other. The shadow began to lengthen.
Now it gets real interesting, boys. Camby, slide back and make up a big pot of coffee and brew it strong. Do it before it gets full dark and let the fire die down to coals. Just enough to keep the coffee good and hot. We're gonna need it. If you sleep tonight, you die.
What a cheerful thought.
Darkness soon covered the land. Jamie could taste moisture on his lips. He looked up. Clouds had moved in, obscuring the stars. Rain was not far away. And that was not good for the four defenders. As soon as the rain started, the Apaches would attack, the fallen drops covering any sound they might make. Jamie didn't have to tell the others that. They knew. There was a searing and sudden flash of lightning high above the Mimbres Mountains, and the eyes of the men widened as they caught sight of the warriors coming along the creek, the lightning catching them on the rocks and in the water.
Fire!
Three Apaches made the crossing and leaped onto and then behind the rocks. Jamie fired point blank into the chest of one of the Apaches. Camby deflected the swipe of a knife with the barrel of his rifle and brought the butt around with all his strength. Meanwhile, Jamie wrestled a smaller and younger man to the ground and kneed him hard in the groin. The Apache relaxed his hold on Jamie's arm. Jamie closed one big hand around the Apache's throat and crushed the larynx. Twisting his hand as he did, the Apache thrashed about on the sand and the rocks as he fought for breath that would never come again. Jamie picked up the warrior and threw him out into the clearing.
Anybody hurt?
Get ready for another charge. It ain't over.
Logan wiped off his rifle and thumbed rounds into the tube. The Apaches carried off their dead during the rainy night, then vanished. They had tested the four men and found them worthy opponents. In the pre-dawn, Jamie spent some time scouting around the area on foot.
They've cleared out.
Which way did they go?
West.
Then let's us head north for a spell.
That just might be a right good idea. I allow us to how we pressed our luck pretty hard this go-around.
The men were gone within the hour, heading north and slightly east. Days later, they rode into Socorro on the Rio Grande. Hundreds of miles to the north, the residents of the town of Valley were relaxing after a day of work and a good supper. The cafes were preparing to close and clean up. Card games were beginning in Falcon's Wild Rose Saloon and Gaming House. Cowboys and miners were drifting in for a drink and some talk. Mothers were putting small children to bed. Other kids were studying textbooks and doing homework. Ben F. Washington was working on his manuscript. Falcon knocked on Matthew's front door.
Hey, Falcon, what's the matter?
I just got this telegram from a friend of mine in Kansas.
Let me see that. Asa Pike and gang left here several days ago. Stop. Riding for New Mexico territory. Stop. Believe your father and several friends heading for Albuquerque. Stop. Asa Pike has at least 25 men with him. Stop. Sworn to kill your father. Stop. Best Luke. Who the hell is Asa Pike?
I don't know. One of Pa's enemies, I reckon. I think I'll take me a little ride south.
I'll get my gear together and I'll go...
Forget it, Matt. You're the sheriff here. You can't just up and leave. Big brother Jamie Ian sure can't go. He's getting too fat in the butt. Long ride like that and he wouldn't be able to walk for a month. Morgan's tied down with all his business interests, more so now since he owns controlling stock in the bank. I'm packed up and ready to ride. I've said my goodbyes. I'll get word to you when it's over.
Matthew stood at the door as Falcon walked into the night. Matthew's wife, Jenny, came to his side.
I overheard. Falcon will always be riding off, won't he?
I'm afraid so. He's just like Pa. The wilderness calls to him.
And the wildness.
Yeah, that too.
He's lucky to have a wife like Marie.
Ma liked her. In the short time she got to know her, she really liked Marie.
Within minutes, the rest of the McAllister clan had gathered at the house. Matthew handed them the telegram, and they read it, passing it around.
Who's Asa Pike?
Yeah, I feel really bad about not going with Falcon.
Jamie Ian, when was the last time you sat in a saddle for weeks at a time, love?
Same time I did, Caroline. And it was a few years back.
Hitch up the buggy for me, Jim. I'm going out to spend the night with Marie. She's had time to do her crying and get done with it. Go on now. The rest of you can go on home. There's nothing we can accomplish by standing around with long faces. Besides, we'd better get used to Falcon riding off. You all know he's just like Pa when it comes to that.
Lord knows you're right about that, Megan.
Seated in a small cafe on a side street in Socorro, Jamie felt eyes on him and turned his head. A young cowboy was staring at him, but not in an unfriendly way. The cowboy rose from the counter stool and walked over. He squatted down beside Jamie's chair. Red, Logan, and Canby stopped eating and listened.
You're Mr. McAllister, ain't you?
That's right.
I got some news that might interest you, sir. I just rode in from the northeast. Went up to Kansas looking around. I didn't care for the place. Wind blows all the damn time. You know a man named Asa Pike?
I've met him.
Well, he's put together a band of his kin, and they strutted around up yonder for a time, talking about what they was all going to do to you if they ever caught up with you. And none of it was what I'd call right pleasant.
That is interesting. What's your name?
Rick. Rick Haynes. My grandma used to talk about you, Mr. McAllister.
Pull up a chair and sit down. Do I know your grandmother?
Oh, you probably don't remember her, sir. But she knew you, and when you was little back in Kentucky, she was married to a man named Caney. Her daughter, my ma, married a man named Haynes.
Caney. Sure, I remember Mr. Caney. He was one of the few men who stood up for me when I was living with Sam and Sarah Montgomery after Hannah and me escaped from the Shawnee village.
That's him!
You eating today, Rick?
Well, no, sir, I ain't. I just came in here because it smelled good.
Bring this young man some supper. Now, grab a chair and let's talk about Asa Pike.
Several half-drunk cowboys from local ranches came into the cafe, took one look at the four well-seasoned men sitting with the much younger rider, and wisely decided to leave them alone. The four older men had the look of Curly Wolf written all over them. The cowboys, all Western-born, had learned at an early age that older men could and would kill you quicker than you could blink. And there was something about that big, solid-looking man with the pale eyes and the huge hands that spelled trouble to those with enough sense to read it. The cowboys ordered their supper and kept any sarcastic remarks they might have had to themselves. But not so one young man who strolled in just as the cowboys were being served their meal. He took one look at Jamie and his group and opened his mouth.
What's this? An old folks' convention?
The cowboys exchanged glances and began eating their supper. They wanted to be through before the fireworks started. And they were to a man certain there would be trouble if the loudmouth didn't wise up and do so quickly. Jamie, Red, Logan, and Canby all chose to ignore the young trouble hunter. Rick started to rise from his chair, but Jamie's hand stopped him.
Just forget it. He ain't worth the effort to swat him.
What? Did you say something about me, old-timer?
Oh, goddamn.
Don't push them in, Laredo. Leave it alone.
Shut up, Charlie! Mind your own business!
Suit yourself, Laredo. It's your funeral.
You think...
Shut up, boy! Jamie turned around, picked up his fork, and began eating his piece of pie.
What? Charlie, did you hear what this old buzzer bait just said to me?
Yeah, and I was you, I'd heed that advice. I just now figured out who that man is. That's Jamie Ian McAllister.
McAllister? Why, hell, he must be nearby 100 years old. Where'd you park your cane in your crutch, old man?
Jamie kept his peace and ate his pie.
Laredo, McAllister just got off a 2-year manhunt. He killed some 50-odd men during that time. Doesn't that tell you anything?
I don't believe none of that. I don't believe half of what I said about McAllister.
Laredo moved closer to the table and leaned down, bent over at the waist, and he put his mouth about a foot from Jamie's ear.
Do you hear me, old man? I said, I don't believe none of them things they said about you. I don't believe you fought at the Alamo. I don't believe you're no fast gun. But I do believe you're a big bag of wind. I think you made up all them things yourself. I think you're a liar.
Jamie brought his right elbow up and around fast and hard. The elbow caught the punk flush in the mouth.
Oh, fuck.
Jamie stood up and snatched both of Laredo's guns from their holster, tossing them on the table. Jamie hit him with short, chopping punches, lefts and rights to the face. Laredo lay on the cafe floor, unconscious. Jamie reached down and stripped the gun belt from the man, tossing that on the table, too. Then he picked up Laredo and threw him out the door. Jamie returned to the table, sat down, picked up his fork, and began eating the remainder of his pie. cowboys finished their meal and very quietly left the cafe. To a man, they were hardened, accustomed to doing brutal work from sunup to sundown, and there wasn't much they hadn't seen and damn little they would back away from. But they had never seen such an emotionless and ruthless beating administered in such a short time.
Rick, that pistol of yours is so old, I wouldn't want to be around when you fired it. Go on, take those guns. Laredo won't be needing them. If you're going to ride with us, you'll need to be well armed.
The pistols were brand spanking new Colts, Army model, caliber 45.
You get enough to eat?
Oh, yes, sir. My belly's about to pop. I thank you for it.
Stop calling me, sir. My name's Jamie. Let's find us a place to sleep. We'll pull out early in the morning.
Several months after the birth of their child, William and Paige Haywood left Denver and moved to Valley, where William hung out his shingle and started his practice of law. The baby was dark-haired, blue-eyed, and fair-skinned. Russell Clay was more than delighted to see the young couple leave Denver. Now he could get on with the rest of his life without fear of bumping into his niece every time he stepped out of the door. But there was still the matter of his sister to be resolved. Russell knew that she had hired detectives to find him, just as she knew that he had hired detectives to find her. A showdown between brother and sister was inevitable. It was just a matter of time. Both Russell Clay and Andrea Petrie had hired detectives to travel to Valley to find out what her son and his nephew, Ben, was up to. Both were horrified to learn that he was going ahead with his plans to write a book about the McAllister family and everyone connected with him over the past 50 years. Each of them, without the other knowing it, started making plans to rid themselves, once and for all, of Ben F. Washington, and each other if the opportunity should arise.